The Pavilion in the Clouds, written by Alexander McCall Smith and read by David Rintoul. This began in 1938, in what was then Ceylon, in a bungalow halfway up a hill. On occasion, when conditions were right, this house would be shrouded with cool mist, like thin, attenuated rain, and in this way would be made invisible from the plains far below. Around it, green swathes of hillside were covered with lines of tea bushes that stretched out to disappear into scrub and jungle. Only human effort, patient and untiring, kept the wilderness at bay here. That task was endless, involving the imposition of a sense of urgency that was alien to the wisdom of this place, a negation of old courtesies, of ancient pride. Most people here came from somewhere else, from India, across a brief stretch of ocean, or from a remote source of men and ships, and the capital that was needed to get anything done. So this made it a place of strangers, uprooted from elsewhere, and all aware that home was a long way away. The idea of home was something you carried somewhere inside you, together with an understanding that you would never be fully accepted, even if you happened to be born in this country. And you had ways of compensating for that, by making the place you found yourself in seem as much like home as possible. And you invoked memories of home and took comfort from them. For the Scots who worked there in the tea trade, these hills could be anywhere in the Western Highlands of their native land, remembered with longing on lonely maudlin evenings, toasted at the annual Burns supper in the panelled dining room of the club, a landscape of the heart that they did not expect, nor particularly want, others to understand. The bungalow was typical of its sort, of a style that had been planted, uninvited, across vast swatches of a rambling, already doomed empire. It was essentially British, but there was also something slightly Dutch about it, as the Dutch had been there too, and had left their architectural mark in a taste for gables. The dominant feature, though, was the veranda, which was deeper than most, and which ran round three sides of the building, a dark mouth into which windows and corridors opened into shadowy interiors. Planters' chairs, with their swivelling extensions, appeared in clusters at various points on this veranda, allowing sunrise and sunset to be viewed from different vantage points. Beside each chair was a small table, consisting of a brass tray top and carved wooden legs. The brass trays had, beaten into them, designs of trailing leaves and the occasional helmeted warrior from an ancient epic or an animal. One had a large and benign Ganesh at its centre, trunk and arms raised in benediction. Another had the coiled shape of a king cobra, its hood extended, an exaggerated forked tongue protruding from its mouth. "That tongue," Bella's mother said to her, "that tongue isn't the dangerous bit, you know. It looks like it, but it's the fangs you have to watch out for. The tongue is out like that so the cobra can smell. It smells with its tongue, you see,